Trial by Mob, Part 2. Warning, this program is not suitable for young listeners due to content and the frequent use of racial slurs of the time. Part 2 of Trial by Mob takes up the events after three young black men, Isaac McGee, Elmer Jackson, and Elias Clayton, accused of the rape of a white woman, were pulled from their jail cells and lynched by a mob numbering in the thousands.
Hello, this is Milton Cotter at the WDDS Studios updating the tragic story of the lynching of three black men two nights ago in a downtown Duluth, Minnesota street corner. Today, we can report relative calm throughout the city due to the presence of armed militia and a Naval Reserve gunboat patrolling the Duluth Harbor. Rumors of further rioting have occasionally surfaced during the past hours. However, both local police and National Guard officers don't believe citizens will attempt anything further.
That's right, Milton. Sharon Ball here, and as I've interviewed people in the neighborhoods and downtown streets during these past 2 days, there's a sense of both sadness and anxiety among citizens. Many regret the tragedy here, but at the same time, folks are wondering what's next. Are local men going to pay a price for their involvement in the jail break-in and lynchings? What would that price be? We don't have any answers yet.
We should know something about that over the next several days. In the meantime, we thought it appropriate to interview Negro residents of Duluth in the aftermath of what has happened. WDDS roving reporter Joseph Richter has returned from an out-of-state assignment and is at the home of Eddie Nichols on 6th Avenue and 5th Street. Joe, we understand that Mr. Nichols endured a harrowing experience himself yesterday.
He did indeed, Milt, and he's agreed to talk to us about it. Thank you for taking time for this interview, Mr. Nichols. So, what happened?
Well, I was getting off work at about 6 o'clock on Monday night, and I went to visit my brother William in West Duluth. When I went in, the house was real quiet. Thought something was wrong. Then I see the newspaper on the table with that headline, West Duluth Girl Victim of Negroes. I froze. Then William came into the room and said, I said, there's gonna be a lynching. William was shook up pretty good too, but he said, but this is up north, you know, Duluth. Maybe it'll just blow over. I was supposed to stay for supper, but I had no appetite, so I left, got on a bus at Grand Ave. Of course it was headed back downtown, and I've never been more scared for my life. There were white men on the street shaking their fists when they saw me on that bus. Somebody screamed, "We're gonna get all the niggers in town!" Well, when I get back home, my neighborhood was normal, like nothing happened. See, I boarded with my friend Wallace Rodney at his house, and he knew what was going on. He was scared too. I went upstairs and got my .45 automatic pistol I bought after my army discharge, took it downstairs, and I told Rodney, "We're gonna be all right." About 2 o'clock in the morning, the doorbell rings. Rodney and his wife looked at me, and I cocked my pistol, went to the door. I opened the door a crack, and here's this white guy. He could see the gun, and he was scared. He says he has a telegram for Mr. Rodney, and as I take it, I tell him, "Mister, you don't know how close you became to being a dead man. See, I was gonna defend my home, and if that meant shooting somebody, I was ready."
What was the telegram about?
Come from the state militia saying they were in town to protect all black citizens, and they wanted Rodney to billet a couple of soldiers for a few days. Rodney refused, and I agree with him.
Why was that?
You're a black man in a city that's just hung three Negroes, and you let troops sleep in your house? Mm-mm! After a couple days, troops are gone, and everybody knows you had them in your house. Who's gonna protect you now? Far as I know, none of our colored here agreed to let troops stay in their homes.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Back to you, Milt.
These lynchings have received national attention, and many newspapers have commented on them. Most condemn the mob's lawlessness, but two here in Minnesota have expressed support for what happened. WDDS reporter Eric Cernan has a summary.
Well, the Ely Miner supported what happened, and we read, "Suppose it was your daughter, sister, wife, or mother. What would you do?" The Mankato Free Press took a stronger view and was the first to defend the mob. And I quote, "The crime which led up to the rule of the mob was more deplorable, and it must be understood that white men will not sit idly by when black rascals pounce like fiends on white women. Mad dogs are shot dead without ceremony. Beasts in human form are entitled to but scant considerations." End quote. Then there's a very different take from the Duluth Ripsaw, a local muckraking journal, raising a question we've not seen in other newspapers. I quote, What puzzles thinking and sophisticated people is the allegation that a tender young girl was raped 6 times by 6 big burly Negroes and then was able to ride home in a streetcar and said nothing to her parents about her terrible treatment. That's the range of coverage I found for the night of June 15th, Mill.
Very different views indeed, Eric. The state militia remains visible in black neighborhoods, and we are seeing what may be described as an uneasy calm in the city. Joining us now in the studio is General F.W. Reinau, commander of the militia that now controls downtown and many residential neighborhoods. General, what's your assessment of the current situation in Duluth?
Our presence has been felt without a doubt. We had no difficulty whatever in getting the remaining prisoners from the jail, as well as those men Chief Murphy brought back from Virginia, into the custody of Sheriff Maggie at the St. Louis County Jail. I've assigned 19 of my troops to guard those cells. And let me be clear, no one will get any more Negroes until the last soldier has been killed and many of the rioters. I have given orders to shoot to kill.
With us now in St. Louis County, Attorney Warren Green, who is in charge of prosecuting the rioters and has just concluded a conference with his staff. Where are you in your investigation, Mr. Green?
Look, make no mistake. Those involved with the lynching will be firmly prosecuted. Let me add that while the original crime was one of the most atrocious ever committed in the county, and neither this nor any other crime justifies resorting to mob law.
This is Eric Saarinen at St. Louis County Courthouse in the chambers of District Court Judge W.A. Kant, who has just convened a grand jury and is issuing instructions to that jury now. Let's listen.
The awful scenes enacted in this city within the past 48 hours have necessitated the convening of your body in extraordinary session at this time. The most atrocious crime in all our history has been committed in the open defiance of authority. That the victims may have committed another crime, also heinous, is not the slightest excuse. Indeed, that is beside the question. They were in the custody of officers and behind barred doors. They were entitled to protection of the law. The great wrong to the victims, wholly beyond our power of estimation, can never be undone. The laws of God and man have been defiled, set at naught. Let everyone know that notwithstanding those incidents, we have a citizenship which denounces such outrageous, will do its utmost to discover and punish the perpetrators thereof.
The words of Judge Kant to the grand jury. We'll be getting a reaction from Sharon Ball, who's with St. Louis County Sheriff Frank Maggie.
Listen, you, if there's any hint of trouble, you'll be facing men trained to shoot, and they will shoot. Bird says if we don't want the jail destroyed, we need to clear out by 5 o'clock tonight. We're lucky to have troops here, at least through the weekend. That's 100 soldiers, and we sure need them.
So we anticipate military presence here until rumors and threats die down.
And that's good news for local citizens. Thanks, Sharon. All right, we're going to be signing off now, but we'll be back just as soon as we learn of new developments regarding the situation in Duluth.
Five-cent nut goodie, the King Bee Nougat, and Ficka's Skookum, a bully good bar. And you can wash it all down with the Ficka's Love It Pop for those hot summer days. Remember, Ficka's, for fine sweets and great treats, located at many fine stores in the Duluth area.
It's been 5 days now since the chaos downtown ended with the lynchings of 3 young Negro men. Spokesmen from law enforcement and the militia appear confident the crisis has passed. Ken Rydell is with someone who may be able to shed light on recent events.
I've received permission to observe a meeting with alleged assault victim Irene Tuscan by an examiner with the Employers Detective Service. The agency and Detective Morgan have been engaged to investigate the lynching for the state. Now, Morgan reports that earlier interviews suggest a possible sexual relationship between Miss Tuscan and her escort that evening, one James Sullivan. He also said that neither Sullivan nor his father agreed to be interviewed. However, Irene Tuscan and her mother will cooperate with the agency, and we are actually in the front room of the Tuscan home here in West Duluth. Mrs. Tuscan and her daughter are entering the front room, and they are sitting on a sofa near Detective Morgan.
So, Irene, you've already told police some of what I'm about to ask, but for our records, perhaps you'd fill me in on a little background. When you were at the circus, how many Negroes grabbed you?
Four.
Did you make any attempt to cry out?
I did, but one of the Negroes put his hand in my mouth.
Didn't Jimmy help you?
He couldn't. One of the Negroes pinned his arms down and another held a gun to his head.
What happened next?
I don't know, because I fainted. Sullivan later told me that four Negroes were fighting on top of me.
Did you feel any ill effects after the assault?
Yes. My arms were a little sore.
What happened then?
We took a streetcar home, and I sat on the porch with Sullivan about a half an hour talking about the occurrence. And then I went to bed.
Why didn't you and Sullivan immediately after the assault go and report it?
I thought it best to keep it quiet.
Well, how did Sullivan come to speak about the matter?
He went to work and told his father about it. And Mr. Sullivan, he telephoned my father, and then they notified the police. Then they went to the circus train with Jimmy. He couldn't identify any of the Negroes, so they came to our house and got me down there to identify them.
How could you identify them more than Sullivan if you fainted immediately after they grabbed you?
I couldn't recognize them by their faces, but only by their size and physique.
Was any of your clothing torn?
One of her garments was torn a little.
Did you have any ill effects after the assault?
She suffered a nervous breakdown.
Well, this nervous breakdown, that was from the notoriety the newspapers gave the case, wasn't it?
This is enough. My daughter needs rest more than anything else.
Well, thank you for your time today.
So, well, Mr. Morgan, do you draw any conclusions from that interview?
When I talked to Dr. Graham, I'm quoting him exactly now, and when I asked him if there were any signs of assault there, he said, I don't think she was raped. So I asked him if a girl was attacked by four Negroes, there would be signs of abuse. Would there not? His answer, you should think so.
I see. So in other words, if there was no rape, what in the world happened?
Your guess is as good as mine.
This is now looking like a much different, even more tragic unfolding. We will, of course, follow this case closely over the days and weeks to come.
This is Milton Carter in our WDDS studio. In the 3 weeks since the alleged assault on a young Duluth woman, St. Louis County Attorney Warren Green has been solidifying charges against those who allegedly attacked Irene Tuscan and James Sullivan, her escort. Green and Duluth police are attempting to recreate the scene at the circus grounds on the night of June 14th when the attack allegedly took place. Our Joseph Richter is on the scene, and we will call on him now.
Milton, the sound you're hearing is from the baseball game at Athletic Park, a short distance from where I'm standing, with Warren Green, several police officials, and 13 Negroes from the circus who have been in police custody since June 15th. James Sullivan and his father are also here. Green is beginning to question one of the men detained by police.
Step forward and state your name. Step forward and state your name.
Max Mason.
Do you own a pistol, Max?
No, sir.
Max, take off your cap and tell us your age and where you're from.
I'm 22, sir. Lived in Decatur, Alabama.
Green is looking at Sullivan, who nods, apparently indicating that Max Mason was among those who attacked Irene Tuscan. He's also speaking to Green.
I think he was the one with the gun, too.
Okay, Jimmy, is there anyone else in the lineup that you recognize?
Yeah. Maybe that one.
James Sullivan is pointing to a man police say is William Miller. Police are now escorting James and his father from the scene. Later, Irene Tuscan will be asked to make identifications as well, and when she does, we'll be right here with that report.
Thank you, Joe. All right, I've just learned that Irene Tuscan will be taken to the rail yard tomorrow rather than tonight. We will return at that time. Stand by. We're sending you to the West Duluth rail yard, where Sharon Ball is waiting for police to bring Irene Tuscan to a lineup of Negro men held on suspicion of assaulting her the night of June 14th. Come in, Sharon.
County Attorney Warren Green has assembled the same lineup viewed yesterday by James Sullivan, the escort of Irene Tuscan, who identified Max Mason and William Miller as probable participants in that assault. It will be interesting to see if Miss Tuscan makes similar identifications. I see she is ready now. Warren Green stands with her before the lineup.
Now, take your time, Irene. We don't want any mistakes here. Do any of these men look familiar to you?
Well, I remember the one with the gun was quite short.
I see. Max, step forward. How tall are you, boy?
I don't know, about 5'4".
He's the shortest man here, Irene.
Then him, I guess.
I see. Okay, who else?
Irene is walking down the line now, looking closely at the Negroes.
Him, I think.
Good. Miller again, good.
Irene Tuscan has identified the same two men that Jimmy Sullivan pointed out yesterday. This would seem to strengthen Warren Green's case against the two Negro men. Now, however, Irene is shrugging, apparently unable to identify others.
Thanks, Sharon. This report will not surprise Duluth's black residents, who predicted as much yesterday. Eddie Nichols, who talked to reporters following the lynchings, has indicated he and other black citizens think it entirely possible that Sullivan spoke to Tuscan and told her to pick the same man he ID'd yesterday. We'll have to see how all of this plays out in court. We will resume coverage of the trials of all defendants as they take place.
As well as mining, mill, railroad, contractors, and lumberman supplies. For all your hardware needs and more, consider Marshall World's Hardware Company.
Hello again, this is Milton Carter. 2 months following the lynching last June 15th, we are back with updates on the trials of men arrested in connection with those lynchings. Our first report comes from Sharon Ball at the courthouse.
We can confirm that three men, Gilbert Henry Stevenson, Carl Hammerberg, and Joseph Dondino, have been convicted of rioting and received sentences of not more than 5 years. Other defendants have either been acquitted or had charges against them dropped by County Attorney Warren Green. 15 men were released following the acquittal of Leonard Hedman, purportedly a leader of the mob. Attorney Green believed if Hedman could not be convicted, chances were remote that others charged would be convicted as their involvement was less prominent than allegedly was Hedman's. We should be able to get some live coverage, however, in the trial of Max Mason, one of the black men held in the alleged assault on Irene Tuscan. Mason is represented by Ferdinand Lee Barnett from Chicago and R.C. McCullough from St. Paul. Joe Richter has some background information on Negro defendant Max Mason.
We've learned that Mason only attended school for 1 week in the first grade. He's drifted from odd job until connecting with a circus last April. He's apparently kept his nose clean until now, and his chances of acquittal here were not helped when it was revealed that he, along with Irene Tuscan, were both infected with gonorrhea. Sharon Ball has entered the courtroom where the Mason trial is taking place.
Max Mason is on the stand and being interrogated by his attorney, Ferdinand Lee Barnett, regarding the gonorrhea discovered during examination back in July.
So you're asking the court, Max, to doubt Dr. Nicholson's diagnosis that you have gonorrhea?
Yes, sir. I don't have no gonorrhea. Now, I had me a dose once about a year ago, but they give me some medicine and I'd be just fine.
Tell me, Max, did you willingly submit to the doctor's examination?
They didn't give us no choice. The jailer said if you don't cooperate, we're gonna throw you in the dungeon with nothing but bread and water.
It's been 4 months since you were examined, Max. In these past 4 months, have you been treated by a doctor for gonorrhea?
No, sir, but then I don't have no gonorrhea no more.
I refer back to Dr. Coventry, whose initial examination of the victim revealed an advanced case of gonorrhea. Thoughtful people might assume such an examination might reveal an early diagnosis, but not an advanced one.
We'll leave that trial now and go to another courtroom, where Eric Saarinen is standing by with progress on William Miller's trial. Eric.
We are watching an aggressive defense attorney here who has questioned and attacked the testimony for the prosecution. Charles Scrutchen, a Negro lawyer from Bemidji, Minnesota, is representing William Miller, who has entered a not guilty plea on the assault on Irene Tuscan. Right now, he's addressing Dr. David Graham, who examined Miss Tuscan following her alleged assault.
As you testified under Mr. Green's questioning, now, Dr. Graham, assuming that the girl's story is true, and that she had fainted at the time the assault took place, would not an attack by six Negroes upon the girl have left physical evidence of tears or lacerations?
I do not think I would have found her in a normal condition the next morning.
Quite so. Thank you, Dr. Graham. Now, gentlemen of the jury, you heard Dr. Boyer and Dr. McDonald both testify it would have been possible for the assault to have occurred without noticeable evidence. But when I asked them if either had any knowledge of a similar case, they both answered no. So in effect, we have heard three prominent physicians testify under oath, calling into question the real question behind this charge. Was the young lady attacked at all, whether by six Negroes or indeed anyone else?
Prosecutor Green is approaching the jury. Let's listen.
Certainly, we want to see justice done in this court, and certainly Mr. Scrutchen wants us to believe his client is not guilty. But what about the girl? God knows she's suffered enough already without having a jury say to her that she is not only a liar, but that she contracted the disease communicated to her by Max Mason from some other person. What are you going to say to her in your verdict? Are you going to brand her as a falsifier and a prostitute?
Charles Scrutchen is ready to make his summation to the jury.
Gentlemen, I'm going to ask you to lay aside natural prejudices of a white man against a black man. If this boy on trial was a white boy and the complaining witness a colored girl, there would be no occasion for me to argue this case before you today. Prejudice? Certainly there is prejudice. We know there is prejudice. This defendant knows that his race is hated, that his color is a crime. No matter how fair you gentlemen of the jury may be, if you return a verdict of guilty, there will always be a lingering suspicion in his mind that he was not given a fair chance because he was black. Still, I believe that you are going to be fair in this case, that there is still a little spark of justice burning, and you will give this boy the presumption of innocence the law says is his. If this girl was ravished as she claims to have been ravished, she would have been taken to a morgue instead of her home.
In a few minutes, the judge will dismiss this jury for deliberation. Meanwhile, the other jury is back with its verdict on Max Mason, and Joe Richter has that report.
Several minutes ago, the jury returned with a guilty verdict for Max Mason. He will be sentenced to 30 years in the state penitentiary at Stillwater.
Max Mason, guilty of rape. Hold on a minute, wait. Joe, I believe, has a reaction from Max Mason.
Max? Yes, Max? Max? What do you have to say about this?
I ain't guilty. Never knew nothing about no white girl getting raped. I ain't done nothing wrong.
Deputies are taking him from the courtroom now. Max Mason will serve 30 for the June 14th assault on a local woman. Milt, back to you.
Thank you, Joe. We should be hearing soon from Eric Saarinen with William Miller's verdict. Until then, we're going to get some reactions from Duluth citizens about the Mason decision. Ken Rydell is on Superior Street.
Thanks, Milt. Yep, here's a young man just leaving Lion Drugstore. Excuse me, sir. The jury has just convicted Max Mason of rape. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You bet I do. I say it's about time, and what took so long? If I'd have been on that jury, I wouldn't have wasted all that time with folks blabbing this and that. Look, we'd have saved time and money if they'd all been hung last June. Still, the main thing, it'll be a long time before niggers try anything with white women in Minnesota.
I see a lady coming. Ma'am, what's your reaction to the conviction of Max Mason?
Well, it was awful what happened to that girl. I heard, though, that maybe she's sort of brought it on herself, but I wouldn't say for sure. I shouldn't be talking to you about this, excuse me.
I'm just receiving word that we have a verdict on William Miller. Over to you, Eric.
The word here is not guilty. William Miller has been acquitted. Milt Carter is also on Superior Street in front of the police station. Milt, what's the reaction down there?
There really isn't a gathering here, Eric, just folks passing by, but, well, here's a gentleman in a business suit who agreed to talk with us. Thank you, sir. So what are your thoughts on this right now?
Well, it's not real clear, is it? One conviction, one acquittal. Hard to know what to make of that. I think this whole affair was shameful, that people in this city would have done what they did last June. On the other hand, there'll be people here who'll be mad that somebody got off, and they'll be up in arms and say all the prisoners should have been lynched, but when you stop and think for a minute, seems to me that the acquittal of Miller puts a lot of doubt in people's minds about what really did happen at that circus.
And folks are now nodding in agreement. But before signing off, let's hear from this fellow.
All this fuss over practically nothing. Big waste of time and money. Most of the guys I know have been wondering why there's all this whoop-de-doo. I mean, it was just niggers.
Wow. So that's what this is all about.
That's not the end of the story, though, is it? I mean, what happened afterward?
Well, the lynchings were forgotten. Nobody talked about them. Records were hidden, and for decades, local people didn't have access to them. Books on crime in Minnesota, even history books about the state, didn't mention the Duluth lynchings. But even though most people never heard about them, the lynchings impacted northern Minnesota for years.
That's right. Black folks had trouble finding work in Duluth. Black college students weren't allowed to practice teach in city schools. And racism really took hold in this region. Now, three generations after the lynchings, if you knew someone here who expressed racist views and asked how he came by them, if he were truthful, he might say he picked them up from his parents or grandparents. Those people likely got them from their parents who were around in 1920 and bought into the racist notion that blacks were likely to be criminals. But all this started with a lie, that black men raped a white woman. And incidentally, there was no medical or physical evidence that a rape occurred. This never came out in the newspapers of the day.
Well, anybody know what happened to Max Mason or any of the others?
I'm glad you asked. Mason was sentenced to 30 years, but he served less than five. Sounds like a wrongful conviction. The white men convicted were paroled after only 2 years. Irene Tuscan became a housewife, lived to the age of 95 in Superior. She never publicly spoke of the incident. Her friend, James Sullivan, according to acquaintances, turned into a somewhat reserved adult. If you want to learn more, there's the book The Lynchings in Duluth by Michael Fido, as well as a lot of material at the Duluth Lynching website of the Minnesota Historical Society, as well as one for the Clayton Jackson McGee Committee. That's where teachers can download a curriculum on the lynchings for classroom use.
We're finished here, folks. Tell your friends that something positive came from this because Duluthians acknowledge the awful event, and this memorial is their promise to build community and harmony, incorporating race, class, gender, and religions. Something to think about, isn't it?
Trial by Mob, The Duluth Lynchings, was produced by KVSC 88.1 FM at St. Cloud State University in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Our cast includes Lee Adams, Jack Bybee, Karina Borash, Judy Fido, Michael Fido, Sam Landman, Anthony Lockhart, John Peterson, Caroline Poole, Bucko Salo, J.T. Scott, Andy Valenti, and Eric Webster. Our sincere thanks to KVSC volunteers for bringing the mob to life. Trial by Mob, The Duluth Lynchings was written by Michael Fido, produced by Joe McMullen-Boyer, engineered by Nick Hendrickson, and directed by Carol Cooley. Support for this program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, as voted on by the people of Minnesota on November 4th, 2008.